Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, February 22nd, 2018. I'm asking you to please have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down the names, addresses, emails, web pages, and phone numbers so you can take action for the environment. Let's get started with announcements. The California Native Plant Society Habitat Restoration Team is having a restoration this Saturday, February 24th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park here in Santa Cruz. We will continue our broom bash efforts, removing non-native French broom. Let's hope for some rain soon. We got some sprinkles in the last few days, but not enough to get that broom out of the ground. How to get to Quail Hollow? Well, take Graham Hill Road up from Santa Cruz, come down the hill into Felton, turn right at the first light, and drive 2 miles up Cianti Road. Turn left on Quail Hollow Road. The park entrance is a half a mile up on the right side. Meet at the gravel parking lot on the left side of the entrance road. We are a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands in Santa Cruz County. Our program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. We welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80 as well as special group projects. Wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine. But if things get particularly unpleasant, they'll call it a day. Tools are provided. Bring your gloves and water. For more information, go to their website, www.cruzcnps.org. That's www.cruzcnps.org. And there'll be a climb camp March 26th through April 1st. Cascadia Forest Defenders invites you to a week-long climbing camp, probably in Oregon. Come spend time in the woods learning how to ascend and descend a static rope traverse between trees. Use a crossbow to get up in the tree, build and set a platform in the tree, build road blockades involving aerial structures, and much more. They want you to RSVP to forestdefensenow@gmail.com. That's forestdefensenow@gmail.com. And once again, the date for that climbing camp is March 26th through April 1st. If you want more information, go to their webpage, www.forestdefensenow.com. And the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project is having a speaking tour, and they might be coming to a city near you. In this story from the Earth First Update, Newswire. Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project is excited to announce a series of lectures by Karen Coulter, a veteran Earth Firster, lifelong forest advocate, and founder of Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project. Anyone in the Northeast or Northwest who is interested in the history and practice of forest defense is encouraged to attend. All three lectures are free and include refreshments and a question and answer session with Karen afterwards. Here's the schedule. February 27th. From 6 p.m. at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, New York, and March 2nd at 3 p.m. at New York University, New York, New York. For more information on this tour, please go to their website, bluemountainbiodiversityproject.org. And the Mono Lake Committee is hiring for seasonal jobs this summer. If you've always wanted to spend a summer at Mono Lake, now is your chance. We still have openings for seasonal staff positions for summer 2018, including an intern, a canoe program coordinator, outdoor education instructor, and information center and bookstore assistant. Summer in Mono Lake is the busiest and most activity-filled season, and seasonal staff jobs include leading interpretive tours, helping visitors in the bookstore, and canoeing on Mono Lake, among the many other varied tasks. We accept applications from people of all ages, whether you're looking for an internship between college semesters or if you're interested in a post-retirement summer of work. To apply, please send a cover letter and resume to Office Director Jessica Horn, either by email or mail to P.O. Box 29, Lee Vining, California, 9-3-5-4-1. That email address is jessica@monolake.org. That's jessica@monolake.org. And for more information, go to the webpage www.monolake.org. And take action, tell Interior Secretary Zinke and the U.S. Forest Service Chief Took to protect the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness by not renewing the Twin Metals mining leases. On the Friday before Christmas, the Trump administration released a new legal opinion that may allow the renewal of two mining leases adjacent to the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness, so a company owned by a Chilean billionaire can construct a copper and nickel mine in the watershed of the Boundary Waters Wilderness. The Chilean billionaire, Andronico Luksic, also happens to be renting a mansion to President Trump's daughter Ivanka and son-in-law Jared Kushner. The legal opinion from Trump's Interior Department doesn't immediately greenlight the toxic sulfide mine within the Boundary Waters Wilderness watershed, so please take action to stop one of the most toxic forms of mining, which has caused environmental and financial problems all over the world. The Boundary Water Canoe Area Wilderness is America's most popular and water-rich wilderness. Its 1.1 million acres contain more than 1,000 pristine lakes and 1,200 miles of rivers and streams. Lakes, rivers, and streams of the Boundary Waters watershed are among the cleanest waters in North America and are especially sensitive to acids and heavy metals found in copper mine pollution. You may recall that these expired mining leases were previously not renewed by the U.S. Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management due to the extreme environmental risk they posed to the Boundary Waters wilderness. In fact, the Forest Service received over 125,000 comments opposing the mining leases, including 10,000 comments from Wilderness Watch members and supporters, and almost no comments in support of leasing. Under the mineral leasing laws, the Department of Interior issues mineral leases on all federal lands. However, the Forest Service has veto power over any leases issued on the national forests. Therefore, both the Forest Service and the Department of Interior must approve any decision to lease the lands next to the Boundary Waters. Priceless and irreplaceable, the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness must not be put at risk of perpetual water pollution from the most toxic industry in the United States. And if you want more information on how to make your comments, please go to wildernesswatch.org. And the update from the field from the Buffalo Field Campaign. We are so humbled by everyone who has reached out to us, even making donations in memory of the matriarch Buffalo S3. Your letters, emails, and contributions in her name move us deeply. This beautiful Mama Buffalo touched so many hearts, and she will live on in everyone who remembers her and shares her story. She lives on in her surviving family members who, after losing her to a hunter, have been keeping themselves safe and away from danger. She and her family are representative of what so many of the buffalo of Yellowstone Country endure. So many buffalo have shared the same fate, and others are about to experience an even worse one. Yellowstone has opened their buffalo trap. As of this writing, at least 96 of the country's last wild buffalo, our national mammal, are imprisoned in the Gardner Basin within Yellowstone National Park's Stevens Creek Buffalo Trap. These buffalo are facing a sentence of death by slaughter or domestication by quarantine, which, contrary to popular belief, also sends buffalo to the slaughterhouse. People often ask us, how long does a buffalo live? Usually our first response is, that depends on if they migrate into the Gardner or West Yellowstone basins or not. In a press conference issued on Tuesday afternoon, Yellowstone did not fail to point out the Native American tribes would be shipping the buffalo to slaughter, aiming to shift the blame away from themselves. While it is true that a few tribes have slaughter contracts with Yellowstone, the park is fully responsible for their own actions. It is Yellowstone who is bending over backwards to serve Montana cattle interests by capturing wild buffalo, operating the trap, and forcing buffalo through invasive procedures as they are run through the terrifying squeeze chute, separating mothers from children, causing trauma and injury, and loading these sacred beings into trailers destined for slaughter. The only thing the park isn't doing is putting the bullet through their heads. Everybody working at Yellowstone's trap wears the same buffalo-bearing badge on their sleeve. Yellowstone National Park put many thousands of wild buffalo through this torture chamber, and they have the most wild buffalo blood on their hands than any other entity since the turn of the 19th century. In the public eye, they feign regret, saying they are forced by Montana to kill the last wild buffalo because of a court order, claiming their hands are tied and they have no choice but to carry out these draconian acts. We do believe that there are many who work within Yellowstone, even some who work the trap, who didn't join the Park Service to kill buffalo and strongly oppose their agency actions, oppose their own actions even. But inertia is a powerful force and cowardice is comfortable. Yellowstone and their employees are choosing to do this. They have a way out, more than one, but they continue to make the choice to kill sacred buffalo. And environmental activists have been attacked in Mexico and their bus lit on fire in this story from the Earth First Newswire. Activists opposing a hydroelectric project in Puebla, Mexico, were traveling back home in a rented bus when armed masked men stopped them. A group of environmental activists traveling from Zacatlahuic to Tehuacan, Mexico, were attacked Saturday after protesting the Atzala Coyolapa hydroelectric project in the Sierra Negra, the mountain chain that crosses the state of Puebla. When driving by Zacoapan, a black double cabin pickup truck blocked their way and masked armed men forced the activists to step out of the bus, get on their knees, face the bushes by the road with their heads down, and wait until they sprayed gasoline over the bus. When the attackers left, the activists turned their heads only to see their bus on fire. They weren't able to identify any of the attackers or the truck's details. Some have pointed out the bus could have been attacked because it belonged to a company outside of Puebla rather than a local one. However, victims believe it was an act of political intimidation for their activities against the hydroelectric project. The Sierra Negra de Puebla is a region under constant threat of mining, manufacturing, and other environmental threats in a mostly indigenous territory. Activists and local residents fear the new hydroelectric dam may damage the region's ecosystem. The project consists of three different dams spread out along 7 kilometers on the Coyolapa, Atzala, and Huitzala rivers, affecting about 160,000 people in the area. The plants have an investment of 327 million Mexican pesos, about $17.5 million, and will provide energy to local mines and manufacturing enterprises for the next 30 years. The project will be taken over by the Hydroelectric Company of Puebla and the Hydroelectric Projects of Puebla, a branch of the railroad and mining Mexican group GFM. The main beneficiary will be the Otlan Mining Company in Tezhuatlan, which provides metal alloys to GFM. The main dam will rise 11 meters above the Coyolapa River, where more than 77 hectares of forest will be chopped down. Since it's mainly indigenous territory, the government must carry out popular consultations to approve the project. However, local residents have denounced it as a treacherous, claiming the consultation shouldn't even happen. The mayor has sold out to the company, said Martin Barrios, president of a human rights group in Tehuacan. He resembles more a legal representative than a mayor. In a meeting, they had a screen, a mock-up of the project, and a truck full of beer for the people. Barrios claims the project would affect local ecosystems, agriculture, ranching, water tables, and fauna. About 17 different indigenous communities are organizing to stop the construction and support the wild and scenic designation for the Mokelumne River. It's a crucial time for the Mokelumne River, and we need your help. The California Natural Resource Agency has just released their Mokelumne River Wild and Scenic River Study Report, and they're encouraging public comment until next Monday, February 28th. We are very glad to read the report that 37 miles of the North Fork and Main Stem qualify for state protection as a wild and scenic river. With this designation, the Mokelumne River will be closed off to new dams and major water diversions, and extraordinarily scenic and recreational values protected well into the future. The Mokelumne River deserves this because it provides critical habitat for native salmonids, the McCollumney is not stocked with trout or manages a fishery in any of the proposed protected sections, yet robust populations of wild trout persist in all these reaches. This is a testament to the quality of the habitat and the presence of cold, clean water. Ecotourism is one of the world's fastest-growing economic generators, and the McCollumney has more potential to generate revenue for the community if the free-flowing sections remain free-flowing. It provides a uniquely broad range of recreational opportunities, from mellow camping to high-adventure whitewater kayaking. With the proper management, the McCollumney has the potential to be a trophy trout fishery. A free-flowing river connects with the hearts and minds of visitors much deeper than a reservoir. Last but not least important, McCollumney River is already tapped out. There are currently 6 dams and 5 working powerhouses on the McCollumney. It supplies water and power to tens of thousands of Californians, including the entire East Bay. While the protected segments will be closed off to big water diversions, many types of upstream water development would be allowed so long as such projects do not adversely affect the free-flowing condition and natural character of the river. Besides dams are the 19th century technology, it's time to shift our focus to water conservation, groundwater basin recharge and storage, off-channel water storage, and other innovative solutions so we can better coexist with native fish and other wildlife. Please go to Friends of the River or Cal Trout, where you can find resources to make your comments. Once again, make your comments for the wild and scenic designation for the McCollumney River at www.caltrout.org. And in Arizona, there's a fight over artificial snow made from treated sewage on sacred peaks. In this story by Emery Cohen of The Guardian, as found on the Earth First Newswire. To the Hopi tribe, the San Francisco peaks are sacred. A cluster of mountains rise dramatically from grasslands and ponderosa forests in northern Arizona, and the Hopi say they are home to spiritual beings called Kachinas that are believed to bring rain and snow to their reservation. But the tribe has been allowed to move forward with a lawsuit against a local ski resort over what the tribe deems to be a desecration of the Holy Mountains, spraying artificial snow made from treated sewage water. People compare it to baptizing a baby with reclaimed water, said Ed Kabuti, a tribal Hopi member and artist. Nobody would think about doing something like that. Signs around the Arizona Snow Bowl Resort, about 15 miles from Flagstaff, warned skiers not to drink the water used in making snow, but state regulations allow for its use in irrigating crops and watering parks. It has been found to contain trace amounts of substances such as Prozac, DEET, and ibuprofen. They occur in the order of a few dozen to several hundred parts per million, which, for comparison, is far less than a grain of salt in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. In its complaint, the tribe contends that the purity of sacred sites and natural resources will be compromised by artificial snow that gets blown outside the ski resort boundaries or seeps into the surrounding forest as it melts. Even the act of making snow, of turning a man-made technology to replace the natural water cycle, goes against Hopi beliefs, said Lee, a recently retired Hopi Cultural Preservation Office director. Is the duty of the spiritual people, the Kachina people, to bring that snow, Lee said. For a people who have learned to live with the cycles of the sun, the moon, seasons, and moisture, making snow is kind of like shaking your fist at God, Kabuti said. The Hopi's opposition to snowmaking echoes other recent efforts by Native American tribes to stand up against oil pipelines and mining on historic and sacred lands. In many cases, such as Arizona Snow Bowl, these areas are now designated as public lands and are under the control of the federal government. And as climate change brings warmer and drier conditions to the U.S. Southwest, snowmaking is a hedge against shorter snow seasons and precipitation falling as rain instead of snow. There have been just 34 inches of natural snowfall at the resort this winter, too little to keep it open for business. But thanks to the snow guns, the resort has made about 3/4 of its run skiable with a thick layer of man-made powder. I don't ever question tribal beliefs or culture, I don't question that when they say it's sacred, but it's public land with a land use designation for a ski area, and it has been designated that way since 1938, said J.R. Murray, Arizona Snowball's general manager. There are hundreds of thousands of people per year who enjoy the recreation we provide, and the snowmaking sustains that. And in Poland, we read that Poland has upheld a promise to comply with the European Union's top court final ruling on logging in this story from Reuters News. Poland will comply with the final ruling of the EU top court on logging in its Białowieża forest, the environment minister said on Tuesday, after an advisor to the court said Warsaw breached EU law with increased wood harvesting in the forest. At this moment, I can confirm that Poland will comply with the final judgment regarding the Białowieża forest, the environment minister Henryk Kowalczyk was quoted as saying in a statement. The ministry also said that the court's advisor opinion was not binding and that the court's final ruling would most likely take place in April of this year. And that certainly doesn't account for all the wood that they've already cut. And there's an illegal global trade on pangolin in this story from Science News, as written by the University of Stirling. Animal traffickers are taking advantage of remote ivory trade routes to smuggle pangolins, one of the world's most endangered animals, out of Central Africa, a new study has found. The solitary mammals sought after for their meat and scales are being transported across remote forest borders in a largely successful attempt to avoid increasing law enforcement, according to groundbreaking research led by the University of Stirling. In the first ever study to investigate how criminals are sourcing pangolins in African forests, experts found that local hunters in Gabon are selling increasing numbers of the animals to Asian workers stationed on the continent for major logging, oil exploration, and agro-industry projects. In another significant finding, the team discovered that the price for the giant pangolins has risen at more than 45 times the rate of inflation between 2002 and 2014. The study is published in the African Journal of Ecology, World Pangolin Day, and experts believe it will help law enforcement tackle the increasing problem. Dr. Catherine Abernethy, of the Faculty of Natural Sciences, led the work, which also involved the University of Sussex, Gabonese researchers, and other industry partners. This is the first study of how illegally traded pangolins may be sourced from African forests, and it shows that the high value paid internationally for large giant pangolin scales is probably affecting their price, even in very remote villages, Dr. Abernethy said. However, local subsistence hunters are probably not the primary suppliers. This is likely to be criminal hunting organizations, possibly those who are also trading in ivory in the region, as the demand markets are similar. Found in Asia and Africa, pangolins are scaled, primarily nocturnal animals, which feed predominantly on ants and termites. The eight species of pangolin range from vulnerable to critically endangered, with their meat and scales in high demand, especially in Asia. With the decline of Asian species in recent years, there have been a significant increase in the number of African pangolins seized in Asia. Consequently, in 2016, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, or CITES, had a multilateral treaty to protect endangered plants and animals, banned all international trade in the African species in a bid to restrict wildlife losses. And a startling orangutan population decline has been recorded in Borneo in this story by Will Dunham of Reuters News. Hunting by people and habitation destruction by oil palm, paper, logging, and mining industries helped drive a startling drop of about 50% in the orangutan population on the island of Borneo from 1999 to 2015, scientists said. The researchers calculated the population decrease of about 148,500 during that 16-year period and projected another drop of 45,000 by 2050, painting a bleak picture for the future of these shaggy, reddish tree dwellers that are among the world's most imperiled great apes. Orangutans inhabit lowland forests on Borneo, an island shared by Indonesia, Malaysia, and Brunei, and the Indonesian island of Sumatra, where they eat wild fruits, insects, bark, flowers, and leaves. Deforestation was only part of the danger. Around 70% of the loss in Borneo's populations may have resulted from orangutan killings by people in forested areas, the researchers said. People have hunted orangutan for their meat in Borneo since they were colonized the area, as they hunt any other edible animals, said biologist Maria Voigt of the German Center for Integrative Biodiversity Research and the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology. The orangutans are not their preferred prey species. This is rather pigs and deer, but they also take one when encountered. Killing also occurs in situations where humans are frightened or startled by orangutans, for example, when orangutans enter gardens or plantations to snack on the crops. The researchers tallied arboreal nests for these apes and used satellite images to appraise forest loss, determining that there were between 200,000 and 300,000 Borneo orangutans in 1999 and only 70,000 to 100,000 in 2015. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right in here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. You can hear a rebroadcast of this show tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. That's Friday at 3 p.m. as part of our Environment Friday programming. You could also tune to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Fridays at 5:30 in the morning, KRFP 90.3, Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m., KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m., and WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon. You can also listen to KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill and Gilroy, California, KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, and KPHD 93.3 in Modesto, California, or Berkeley Liberation Radio at 104.1 in Berkeley, California. You could tune in online at the Grateful Dread Public Radio. That's GDPRRevolution.com. Once again, that's GDPRRevolution.com, Sundays at 2 a.m. Central Time. Or you can always go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net, where you can listen online anytime or download this or any previous version of the Earth First Update. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and produced at the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening. And please do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.